He asked about the size of Saudi Arabia. First of all, for the purpose of the tape, I'm John Avery, and this is the second this week in the series on Islam. And tomorrow there'll be a third, not directly related to Islam, but it will be a slideshow on Saudi Arabia that I'll be showing. Just quickly to give you a visual comparison.
Will it be in the afternoon, John?
It's at 7 tomorrow.
Oh,
Saudi Arabia is here, so what, visually a third of the U.S.? Bigger than Alaska? Roughly? For comparison's sake. But not at all having the resources, varied resources. Okay, yesterday we talked about the beginnings of Islam and kind of a way to look at it with an open mind and a good deal of tolerance from our point of view. Because the Arab world is very much in the news these days, Muslims are misunderstood, their actions seem to us harsh and conflict with our own aims and objectives in the world. And so I think it's very important to go at the subject and try to understand them from their perspective, which is quite different from ours. We talked about Muhammad and how the religion started with him, and that he is the person who wrote their scripture, which they call the Quran, and and all the revelation comes through him. So he's the main prophet. They call other people prophets, such as Jesus and Moses and Abraham, but Muhammad then is the prophet. The Quran then is the holy book of Islam, and the word itself means recitation, and Muslims believe that it's an exact replica of a heavenly prototype, and that's a quote, an exact replica of a heavenly prototype that was dictated, recited, to Muhammad. So he somehow received it from the angel Gabriel. I don't think that Gabriel was actually a visual, physical presence to him, but some way of communicating to him. And in some ways, the Quran is even more central to a Muslim, Muslim's life than the Bible is. Because to a Christian, although we follow the Bible and it's our holy book, we think of it more in terms of guidance of the spirit of the word rather than the letter of the law, precisely, particularly in some of Paul's letters. But to a Muslim, it is the word of life and the word of action, and their life and action is integrally tied together. There's no separation there. So in that sense, because they are literalists much, or at least Orthodox Muslims are much more literalists than we are, then the Quran is essential. But it is not a Muslim Bible. It is a whole new version of revelation. It restructures history. It restructures revelation, reorders things, retells it drastically in some places. Jesus, for example, is said not to have died his inglorious death on the cross. To a Muslim, the idea that a prophet of the stature of Jesus could have died a sacrificial death is unthinkable. It's not in the nature of self-sacrifice in the Muslim mindset. So they say that some appearance of Jesus took his place. And Jesus is not the Son of God, very definitely. In the Quran, he is a prophet. In fact, a prophet of Islam, and there's a book I have entitled that, Jesus, Prophet of Islam. Okay, Arabic takes a central role. Arabic is the heavenly language because the Quran is actually our written version of it, or the Arabic written version of it is a replica of a heavenly prototype. Then, Arabic is the language of God, which, of course, is very exclusive of other languages and any serious linguist would have a definite hard time with. So what happened then is that the Arabic that was present at the time of Muhammad, all languages evolved. English, as we know, has evolved from Chaucerian English through Shakespeare, the King James, and into the current state of the language. But to the, and we have arguments, or have had arguments in the past, that the King James Bible is the authorized version and therefore is the version that we should all read and follow. But to a Muslim, there is no such argument. That argument doesn't exist, because there is Quranic Arabic, and that is classical Arabic, and that is heavenly language. So there is no sense of updating the Quran, making it modern. You see, it's not a translation at all. It is in the original. It is in the original language. And so there's no need to translate it. And they are hard-pressed to translate into other languages to make it intelligible to other people. They don't like to do that, and Muslim will tell you you can really only read it in Arabic and understand it fully. I'm told it is beautiful poetry, and it's the essential book. It's a very difficult book to read. It seems illogically organized and full of oblique references, historical references at the time. I guess in some ways we can make the same argument that the Bible. But the way that it's organized, it seems very confusing. It's from the longest chapter to the shortest chapter. It's not organized thematically or chronologically. So you start reading at the back of the book because they're only about 10 lines long. They said, and this is a very important part, that Muhammad was illiterate, that he did not write down the Quran, but he received the revelation and he recited it, and that other people wrote it down on scraps of bone and whatever they wrote on in those days, and that later, after his death, that it was compiled and codified, and they decided what was going to be scripture and what wasn't. But if we look at the history of biblical scholarship and how far apart the words of Jesus from the actual text that we have, you know, it's a lot closer than what we can muster in terms of closeness to the source. There's 114 chapters. As I said, they're not arranged chronologically at all. And some of them are very lyrical, depicting the nature of God. For example, I'll just read a short one. By the fig and by the olive, there's these kind of references which you have to dig into. But anyway, by Mount Sinai and this inviolate land, we molded men, kind of the voice of God. We molded men into a most noble image, and we shall reduce him to the lowest of the low, except to the believers who do good works, for there shall be a boundless recompense. What then can after this make you deny the last judgment? Is Allah not the best of judges? So this kind of rhetorical question-answer, voice of God talking to somebody, prose. Later sirs from Medina are unembellished, and they're kind of direct rules and regulations. For example, believers are to kill no game while on pilgrimage. Set rule. That's what they are to do and what not to do. Lots of details. And it's a very characteristic way of Arabs seeing the world. Lawrence of Arabia wrote a book called Pillars of Wisdom, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And he has a couple of quotes that I want to repeat here. And the first one has to do with the way in which Arabs divide things into yes and no. At the very outset, at our meeting with them, was found a universal clearness, a hardness of belief, almost mathematical in its limitation and repellent in its unsympathetic form. Semites had no halftones on their register of vision. They were people of primary colors, or rather of black and white, who saw the world always in contour. They were dogmatic people, despising doubt, our modern crown of thorns. They knew only truth and untruth, belief and unbelief, without our hesitating retinue of finer shades. So it's very much the Arab mindset to be on or off, hot or cold. And the Quran seems to come down in this way, very definite things in which a person is to do. There are precise prayer times, there's a precise direction to pray in, It seems to be a religion with very little humor. And strict adherence is seen as the purest and the best. Islam, as I said yesterday, means submission, and submission is of primary importance, obedience, and a Muslim is one who submits. A couple points about their concepts of God and religion. Allah is a formless, ageless being, but not an abstraction, not a deistic God. He's always present in the world, in the sense that the Judeo-Christian God is always watching over his creation, and most of all, he is the God of Judgment Day, the God of expectation. Men and women are responsible to him directly. There are no intercessors, there's no organized religion in between them. God is accessible for men. And I think this is a reason that Islam has spread so far and wide, is that it's a clear and direct religion in that way. There's not a lot of complicated theology to it, and there's definite things that you're supposed to do. No other being is supposed to be the subject of worship. Again, they see Christ as being the Son of God is a heretical, polytheistic idea. Islam throughout is intended for purity. Clean, clean like a desert. Most of us think of a desert as barren, but they think of it as a place of purity where the essentials of life are dealt with and there's no time for embellishment. Again, Lawrence of Arabia conveys this feeling in a quote. He came to with some guides to an old desert ruin, and they had traveled across this vast plain of emptiness. And they came to this ruin of the Roman period, in which the Arabs believe was made by a prince of the Roman times, on the border of the desert, a palace for his queen. The clay of its buildings was said to have been kneaded for greater richness, not with water, but with precious essential oils of flowers. So to really be rich in scent, a very romantic kind of idea. And he said, my guides, sniffing the air like dogs, led me from crumbling room to crumbling room, saying, this is jasmine, this one is violet, this rose. But at last one drew me and said, come and smell the sweetest scent of all. And we went to the main window and drank with open mouths of the effortless, emptiness, eddyless wind of the desert throbbing past. This, they told me, is the best. It has no taste. And that sense of purity, cleanness, is kind of an Arab concept, and I think it is very clearly conveyed in their religion. Not a lot of embellishment. Simple obedience, simple knowledge of God and obedience. So then the Quran becomes the basis of doctrine and practice, and together with a compilation of Muhammad's utterances and actions that people remembered and wrote down, called the Hadith. Muslims have a very straightforward way of acting religious practices. You know, they're told how to wash before prayers. Many, many little things that you'll excuse me. One very funny thing that in Saudi Arabia, they're very definite about which directions the toilets can be in. They cannot be in the direction of Mecca, so that if you go into the bathroom, you're not supposed to be going in the wrong direction. So it's that kind of concern for the small things, the ridiculous things in some ways. And I think if you read some of these articles, you see somehow it's extended in very silly ways, which I don't think is the essential part of a religion. So yesterday I mentioned, but I'll go over it again, the five pillars of Islam. The first one is the profession of faith. There is only one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. The ritual prayer of praying five times a day, which they do in Saudi Arabia, and all the shops close, which makes it very inconvenient for getting your shopping done. And not only that, that the shops close, but it's not at a definite time every day, because the prayer time is adjusted to the seasons of the sun. So as the sun moves across the landscape, the prayer times move, you know, as the sun moves throughout the year. So they're crammed together in winter and extended in summer, and you're always guessing, you know, if you don't know, say the prayer time was at 4 o'clock, and you're trying to get your shopping done, and then in a week you go and it may end up at 4:20 that it starts, or if it's the wrong season, at 3:45, and you haven't allowed enough time. So you always have, before you go shopping, you have to know when the prayer times are.
How do you find out?
They're all published in the paper.
How long do they last?
It varies. Some are short, 15 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. And it's not just the time of prayer, but the time for them to get to the mosque and come back to the shop and all that. And some are half an hour. So that's the second pillar. The third one was almsgiving, giving to the poor. The fourth, fasting during the month of Ramadan, where they fast from morning till sunset. Again, a particular of how do you know when it's morning, how do you know when it's evening, is that it said that they could, when you can tell the difference between a white thread and a black thread, then that's morning. When you can't, then that's evening. And during Ramadan, in Saudi Arabia, a cannon goes off in the town to tell us that, okay, it's time to eat. Now, of course, we eat, as non-Muslims, eat in our own homes, but we are forbidden by law to eat open in public or drink. So you have to watch it. I made a mistake at one point this year, and I got some pretty nasty looks. So, and just routinely went up to a water fountain. Okay, and the fifth thing then is the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca that is required of all Muslims during their lifetime, if they can afford it. And they do the rituals, and a Muslim, once he's performed that, he knows that he can die in peace, having completed his obligations on earth.
Does this pertain to women too, or just?
Oh, yes, yes. And interestingly enough, during the Hajj, it's the one time when women are commanded not to be veiled, as they're together, men and women, in the shrine in Mecca, they are commanded not to be veiled, and so they have their bare, open face shown to everybody. So I suppose it is together at that time that you're before God or something. Along those lines. There is no separation of church and state. That's an alien concept to a Muslim. And this really explains why their religion is so closely tied to their politics and actions, and military actions. I have to remember that Muhammad himself was involved in military campaigns. So the idea that you can separate your religion from your way of life is totally alien to them. It's, for one thing, a lot of the practices of life are laid out clearly in their scriptures. So that kind of separation is not a possibility. Islam covers all areas of life, political, domestic, criminal life, as well as devotional life. The Quran is supposed to be the only legal code in Saudi Arabia, criminal code. What is to be done, what's not to be done. And the Sharia, the whole traditions that have built up around the Quran and the Hadith, the saints. There are five categories of acts for all Muslims to follow. One is required, five is prohibited, and the three in the middle are varying degrees of permissibility. Two would be encouraged, three would be permissible, but largely up to the believer himself, and four is discouraged. The Sharia, or the law code, tends to be very specific on things that Muhammad had to deal with, infanticide, raiding of caravans, and so on, things like that, how many wives you can have. But silent on, of course, on things like euthanasia, or water rights, or genetic engineering. So it's up to the individual Muslim, or in many cases, the community of elders, to decide on what's legal and what's illegal. Impose morality. An interesting story is that when the radio was introduced into Saudi Arabia, right away there was a conservative reaction against it, that anything new was going to be bad. But Abdulaziz, who was the king, was very sly fellow, and the first time he used the radio, he read the Quran over it. So he put the religious leaders at a point of having to say that anything that's used to spread the Quran, the word of God, cannot be evil. So it all depends on how you introduce new things. Of course, with all the development that's happened in Saudi Arabia, they want all this modern development and so on. So there are in many quarters disagreements whether these things are holy or of God or not. And the progressives in the country try to see all things as possible, whereas the conservatives or the religious Puritan groups would extend no tolerance towards new things. You know, changes in technology change culture. When you have cars, for example, it changes the social structure of where people live and how they can transmit from one area to another. The television brings in all sorts of airwaves and information that people would not be exposed to otherwise, especially if you talk about people having satellite discs and so on, which I haven't seen any yet, but I suppose it's inevitable that they will get into the country. So Saudi Arabia has always been very... you have to remember, too, that when I talk about Islam, I'm talking about a very small part of it that I know, and that's mainly in Saudi Arabia. But anyway, Saudi Arabia has always been out of the mainstream of world development and isolated, and they prefer to remain that way as far as their traditional values go. But I think in many ways they have a hard time. But they do keep things out, like no pork within the country, you know, pork eaten and all. No alcohol is allowed. There was alcohol allowed in the country until about 1940, and there was a party where a Saudi man who was drunk ended up shooting an American woman and her husband. And at that time, the king said, "This is it. You know, people can't handle it no more." And ever since then, they haven't had it. So, well, there is alcohol and there is drugs in the country, but they are certainly not legal. Many of the expatriate workers make wine, for example. Wonderful grape juice is provided. It's very easy to convert it into wine. They said that people get drugs in, but customs officials are very tough when you enter into the country. You know, they can search you completely at will. So they try to keep everything out. I don't think it would be worth it to a drug dealer to import drugs into that country. I suppose there's a lot of money. There's stories of people going home having made their money off of making booze, but I think that would be a very dangerous thing to do. Generally, if people just make it for their own consumption in their homes, wine, for example, I haven't heard of anybody being bothered unless they happen to draw it. But if they're making it and selling it, then that's a serious criminal offense. Because, of course, they could be selling it to Muslims, too. Just a little bit, then, of Islamic history. What happened after Muhammad? Muhammad died in the year 632. After he died, there was no successor. He had not allowed for any kind of leader. And we have to understand that in the Muslim world, or in the Arab world, that part of the world anyway, the individual leader is so important. Here we have our constitution, and our root of law lies within the constitution. It doesn't matter who's president, but there's a law that we are all to follow, and that the leaders are supposed to follow. But their allegiance, or at least at that time, allegiance was tied to the person. And when Muhammad died, all the tribes in Arabia felt like they were free then to go off and do their own thing again, and they stopped paying the taxes into Medina. So a leader had to be selected, and of the companions of Muhammad, they they elected a man named Abu Bakr, and he became what is called the caliph, and the first caliph, C-A-L-I-P-H. A caliph, then, up until the time of the until the time that the Ottoman Empire was defeated and Turkey became a modern country at the beginning of this century, the caliph has been, or was, the leader of Islam. And this caliph position is very essential in understanding Arab history or Muslim history, because it is the point at which it divides the two different groups of Muslims. There was, of course, jockeying for position of who was going to be the leader. Now, this person who was going to be the leader was going to be the leader of the temporal affairs of the Muslim people, not the religious affairs. He wasn't like a pope in terms of having command over one soul. The Quran stood in that way, and there was no religious leader or prophet after Muhammad. So there was an alliance made, and this Abu Bakr person was brought in, and he was able to bring back the tribes of Arabia and start sending them out in military conquest throughout the region. Now, Mecca and Medina are here. Generally, the tribes of Arabia paid allegiance to him, but they started then expanding up towards Damascus and into Iraq, and eventually over to Egypt, and taking them the Middle East, Palestine, of course, and all of this region under military control. Now, Muhammad died in 632, Damascus was taken in 636, Cairo in 639. So you can see they extended very quickly throughout the region. Now, the reason that they were able to do this was that there were two empires that had existed in this part of the world at that time. There was the Persian Empire from Iran, with the King of Kings, Darius, the famous emperor King of Kings who fought against Alexander the Great. I mean, it wasn't at that time that he was there, but it was that same tradition. And there was the eastern half of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, of course, was based in Rome, but it had split by that time, and its base was in Constantinople, or modern Istanbul. And this is what we knew as the Byzantine Empire. And their point of touching was kind of in a lateral line across here from the Caspian Sea to Palestine, where they fought for control back and forth. And they had carried on these wars for quite a long time, and there was kind of an exhaustion of the two empires. They had worn each other out. And at that time, the red-hot, fiery enthusiasm of this new faith that the Muslims had expanded like a fireball in the Middle East. And in that void of authority, they were able to extend. And Arabia has never been very heavily populated, but the armies were well-disciplined and well-motivated, and they extended throughout this whole region so that all of this eventually became under Muslim control, which was something that had never been done before from the indigenous peoples of the region having control. It had always been outside control for many, many years, I suppose, since the pharaohs, jockeying between the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire. And never control, I don't think, from the Arabians. So they established then their empire and their culture, which became a major force in the region. Allah seemed indeed on their side. Victory was theirs. It seemed like God was blessing their rule. And they were very wise in their territorial gains. They occupied but did not destroy. They subdued but they did not crush. They allowed the people to practice their own religions. They didn't force conversion. And out of this expansion evolved this concept of holy war, or jihad, that we've heard of. Now, jihad is a much larger concept than just war, but it includes it. It also includes a kind of a sense of defense for a duty to God. But it was a special favor to die for God and die for the faith and entrance immediate into paradise. Now, then after this Abu Bakr person was the caliph, he died a natural death. The second and third caliphs were elected and assassinated. There was a lot of jockeying for power and a lot of jealousy. And then the fourth one was Ali. Now this becomes very important. Ali is the person who was Muhammad's son-in-law, and he was also his cousin. So he had a very close association with Muhammad. And remember, closeness to Muhammad means closeness to the center of power. And people thought, the followers of Ali thought, that he should have been the first caliph. He wasn't a natural leader, so he was passed by. But when he was finally elected, there was still a lot of bitterness from the others who opposed him. And in 661, he was assassinated in Iraq, a place called Karbala, which is right here in the middle of Iraq. Right there. Now, Karbala and the assassination of Ali and subsequently the assassination of his son Hussein become the focus of the establishment of the Shiites. The Shiites are those who separated from the mainstream, the Sunnis. And this is something very important to understand today in Islamic history. Sunnis are the mainstream, 90% of Islam. Shiites then are only 10%. And they are the followers of Ali. And it's the Shiites who we hear about today in Iran. It is the official religion of Iran. They are also in Pakistan, some percentage, 50% of Iraq. And they are the followers of Ali. And the way that Ali and his son Hussein died is very important because they died in martyrdom for the faith. So this martyrdom, this willingness to die and joy almost in martyrdom, has become an established tradition in Shia Islam. And it is then the tradition that is behind what we see today in Iran, where thousands of young boys, just boys, 12 years old, are sent in human waves of sacrifice against Iraq in this senseless war that is carried on today. With the understanding that when they die in the war, they will go immediately to paradise. And it's been a leading motivator of Shiism to send people to martyrdom. And it surfaces from time to time in history. And it's the reason that you get people doing car bombings, as they've done against the American and French installations in Beirut and so on. The willingness to die, kind of like in a kamikaze kind of way, you know, for your faith, for your cause.
Do the Sunnis have the same belief?
No. They are politically and militarily motivated, but they're not so keen on martyrdom. And that's why it's a stalemate, the Iran-Iraq war, because there's the Iranians have inferior firepower, military equipment. The Iraqis have much superior equipment, but the Iranians have much superiority in numbers, and they're able to send wave after wave.
But did you say Iraq was 50%?
Yeah, and this is a big disappointment to Iran. See, they thought that once they start getting the message across, you see, Ayatollah Khomeini was in exile in Iraq very close to the time that the Shah was overthrown. It was only the last year or so that he was in France, I believe. And he was kicked out by King, not King Hussein, but is it Hussein who's the head of, President Hussein of Iraq? He was kicked out and exiled again to France. He had been previously exiled from Iran to Iraq and then to France. So he bears a grudge, a personal grudge, against the leader of Iraq. And it was his hope that with the transference of tapes and information into Iraq, that they would hope to mobilize an indigenous local rebellion against the Iraqi national forces. But that's been a big disappointment to Iran, because the Shias in Iraq haven't responded in that way. They've responded more to nationalistic forces to protect their own country. See, to Iran, they don't see themselves as Iran as a country. They see themselves as an Islamic empire, an Islamic country. And they don't recognize national borders. That's why they're trying to expand and send rebellion into all of these Arab countries, trying to, for the cause of Shiaism, and into the Soviet Union and Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, the support they can muster. And the Saudis are very cautious about what videotapes or audio tapes you bring into the country, because they don't want... But one of the main ways that Khomeini was able to control Iran and spread his word and get his name around was through transferring audio messages from France via the telephone lines to Iran. And they were immediately transferred to tapes and copied and sent out through the country, building up the fervor of the people. Actually, he was a much less dangerous person in Iraq because he didn't have that communication connection. And the Shah asked the leader of Iraq to get him out of there, but it was, in the end, a tactical error. So anyway, that's the division of Shiites and Sunnis, and a little bit on the motivation of why they act as they do. You had a question? No? Okay.
Are the Iranians Arabs?
No, no, very important point. Thank you for asking. They are not Arabs, they're Persians. And there is a hatred between Persians and Arabs.
That's part of the reason why the Iraqis didn't...
Yeah, that's right.
The Iraqis are Arabs. Aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, this region of Iran is populated by, the oil-producing region, it's Iran, is populated by Arabs. I think it's called Arabistan or something like that. And this area of Saudi Arabia is populated by Shiites, where we live, the people who work in the oil fields. So they've had to keep careful control. There's a town here called Qatif, which is a traditional oasis of town, beautiful oasis area. And they had a rebellion there. In 1969, if you remember, the mosque, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, was overtaken by rebellious fanatics. At the same time, in Qatif, there was an uprising of the local Shiites. And there wasn't a lot of word that got out about what happened there, but I think they put it down pretty ruthlessly. And now, around the town of Qatif, there's a ring road. And it seems to me obvious why the ring road's there. It's for containment. And you move in the tanks and equipment and just keep the people there. So, that's kind of the political motivation of why our people are as they are. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Who is the Ayatollah?
Who was the Ayatollah?
No, who is the Ayatollah?
There is no one head of Islam. The caliphate was abolished the establishment of modern state of Turkey.
Are there ministers of priests?
No, except in Iran. Generally, there are no paid clergy. People make their life by being clergy.
Well, then who rents their churches?
There is no central authority. It's the local authority of each country or each region. It's a different concept for us because we don't have that kind of structure. In Iran, they have the mullahs, and there are seminaries and so on in different areas, but there's no one established authority. And there never was after Muhammad and one established religious authority, like the Pope or bishops and so on.
Are all the people Islamic? Like in the United States, all the people aren't?
No. Yeah, yes. In Saudi Arabia, all by law, they're all Islamic.
Well, they all have the law. Everyone
yeah.
Who's
a... I don't think there's a question of disbelief. I've never seen anybody question whether they're going to believe or not. I mean, for us, when we were children growing up, excuse me, we may have been raised in the Christian church, but most of us, at some point in our lives, and maybe still struggling with this, of course, we struggle with our beliefs and struggle with, you know, what we believe in the crucifixion and the and Christ's dying for us and absolution of sin. Well, these doctrines which are central to us. But I don't think there's a sense of whether you believe or not.
Well, the Baha'is are an example, aren't they? People who broke away from Islam, and that's their problem.
Yeah, yeah, there may have been over time. There's the Sufis and so on, which have broken away, right? But there's, in mainstream, there's no... I don't think there's any sense of, you know. Yeah.
Those prayers five times a day, is there a set form as to what exactly is prayed, or is there room for individual prayers?
Yes, it's very ritualistic, from my understanding. It's set. I don't think there's individual petitions to that.
Mm. What is the terminology that you're dealing with? Like, you talked about Muslims, you talked about Islam. Are all Muslims?
Yeah, right. If you hear the word association there, Islam and Muslim, let's see, Islam is the religion, like Christianity, and a Muslim is one who follows Islam, like a Christian. So it's a different word form.
And so all Arabs are...
No, not all Arabs are. In Saudi Arabia, all Arabs are Muslims, as far as I know. If they aren't, if they're Christians, or otherwise they don't let others know about it.
There are a lot of Eastern Arabs.
There's well, of course, one of the major problems in Lebanon is the difference between Christians and Muslims, and that's real religious difference. There are many Christian Arabs.
Is there any other religion
in the Middle East? Sure, there's Judaism, and there's, of course, the Christianity, and there's Baha'i faith in Hafia. I visited Israel years back. And one of the main centers of Baha'is is in Hafia, which is on here on the coast. There's a group, kind of interesting development in the history of Islam, is some divisions of the Sufis are a very distinct group in Islam that believes more in a mystical sense. See, traditional Orthodox Islam is kind of dry and arid and doesn't have a lot of life to it in terms of involvement in the person. And the Sufis have, they incorporate more mysticism and relationship to God, personal relationship, and love ethic, love motivation. And that is in contrast to Wahhabism of Arabia. Now, Wahhabi was a person in the 1700s who saw where Sufism was taking Islam, way into some kind of saint worship and mysticism. And he said, no, we have to get back to Muhammad, the Quran, and God, and man, and these four essentials. And this very puritanistic development was coterminous with the development of the history of Saudi Arabia, because Wahhabi and a man named Al-Saud developed an alliance. And this alliance expanded very quickly, was put down, and then expanded again in this century with the followers of Wahhabi and King Abdulaziz Al-Saud, who established Saudi Arabia for the first time since the Islamic Empire as a unified country. And it still is Saudi Arabia after him. And he used this religious puritanical conservatism to bring people under control. And it still is very much a controlling force in Arabia. And I think it's a large reason why the political motivation is a large reason for the pure puritanical bent of the government. Because when you have that kind of control over one's lives and actions and beliefs, you have very strong control over their religion, over their political involvement. And without having to do a lot of subjugation and military control and police and so on, they can do it through moral and social means, religious means.
You're going back over there again. Is there much danger to...
In Saudi Arabia, it's a very stable country. I mean, there is, basically is no crime. You could leave a suitcase full of money. I've watched people walk out of banks with $10,000 in their pocket. And there's no question that they would be accosted and the money taken from them. Now, in terms of, so if you talk about crime from, as we know it, of, you know, street crime and muggings and so on like that, that I would say it's little or no danger. You talk about the destable political military situation. I think as long as Saudi Arabia internally has the money and the oil money to keep going in its development, there will not be a destable situation. Maybe after that money runs out, they will have to have a lot more to worry about. Now, the major thing then, you're probably all thinking, is what about Iran, or what about the Shiites from Lebanon and so on? Well, they have very strong border control, and they rely a lot, and I think the region, the area, relies a lot upon the support of the United States. The United States is slow to act in defense of Iraq, because Iraq is basically a very ruthless government there. But there would be no question in acting in defense of Saudi Arabia, showing some muscle and some definite support. And this is one of the reasons that Reagan and all presidents, not just the Republican, have been eager to provide Saudi with arms. Not so that they can stand up against Israel, being aggressive to Israel, because that's never been a question. Saudi Arabia has never attacked directly Israel. I mean, other Arab countries have. There's a lot of rhetoric of being against the Zionist aggressors, the Zionist occupiers, but there's no direct attack. But the reason that Saudi itself wants to have these arms is to have protection against the Iranians coming in, or form, and this is a socialistic Soviet alliance state, Yemen, which recently had a revolution and has become more radical, and they're afraid of it spreading into North Yemen, into Oman, and these other Gulf states. So they want control in that sense. So
what do you do there?
I teach English. In the university.
Is it an English?
It's an English language only university, so all instruction is in English.
Hmm.
It's quite unique, yeah.
What happens in particular way, the Saudis are very generous, are they not? Don't they have to tithe?
There is, that's one of the obligations of true Muslims is to tithe.
And they must give away that tithe before the end of the year. There's a great deal of generosity.
I'm told that, yeah. I'm told that if you go into a home and you say that, you know, oh, that's a wonderful looking vase, they're actually supposed to give it to you, and there's a tradition of doing that. I think in our region that they are so overwhelmed with foreigners there that we don't get invited in the home. I think that's a relatively new thing. But yes, on a personal level, Saudis can be very charming. I think people have met Arabs in this country and found much to their surprise that they can be very charming people and very warm.
Well, I understand there are no poor there because the people have to contribute.
Well, that's probably true. I don't know all of the social corridors where money is spread out and taken care of before. There's only been a couple of times where I've seen a beggar in Saudi Arabia, or women. And there's probably women who've gotten into trouble and have thus been thrown aside by their families. Usually people are taken care of within the family. But Muslims are supposed to take care of their own.
No, I just wanted to share, I have a slightly different experience. I work in Senegal, West Africa, also very Muslim country, but there it's absolutely filled with beggars. The streets are just packed, especially on Fridays when they're supposed to, as they go to the major prayer of the week, it's very good for them for getting to heaven or whatever if they can give to beggars.
Yeah. Senegal is,
West Africa.
West Africa,
that
okay.
Makes it sort of its own culture. African Islam, like African Christianity, has become really uniquely African.
Mm-hmm.
It's much less orthodox, certainly, than what you know in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different Islam, very much based on sort of amulets and good luck charms and writing verses of the Quran to protect you from evil spirits.
Mm.
That's really unorthodox.
Nathaba. In Saudi Arabia. Heresy. So, yes.
Is there much concept of forgiveness? Is that at all central to the Islamic faith or is it Christianity?
Yeah. I have some things here. Let me just go through these notes quickly. How we can perceive some things. How we can perceive Islam as a religion. Positive things, I think, are is it's pure monotheistic religion that we can have an affinity with. Tolerance espoused to us as people of the book. I don't know how much tolerance you find in Senegal. We don't find any in Saudi Arabia. But it's supposed to be extended to us as Christians and Jews. There's a lack of self-consciousness, and there is a confidence, I didn't write that exactly as I meant, in being different from one's religion. There is no sense of being ashamed of being a religious person. So I see that as a positive thing. And there's a very much a righteous respect for God. The negative things I see is they view God mainly as a judge. Oh, I'm sorry. God mainly as a judge. The vulnerability is unthinkable. The cross is unthinkable. It's in the folly of the Christian system. The idea that God sent his son to die for us, John 3:16, is not at all something they can buy into.
But yet their leaders were martyrs and they looked up to them.
Yeah, but it's a martyrdom that was not a self-sacrifice. In a sense, I mean, sure, you sacrificed yourself, or was for political means or military means for gain. Whereas Christ's martyrdom was nothing to gain for himself. There's nothing he gets from that. It's totally for the benefit of us. Because he had, in our doctrine, there was no sin in Christ. Okay. I also see as a negative point a rigid self-righteousness. I really understood Pharisees after I got to Saudi Arabia. And that whole thing of understanding the people of the Bible is really something that comes alive when you're in the Middle East. Real strong, stern, humorless types. So I know bending rules. Some technical problems I see with the Quran. Changing history. And special revelation to Muhammad seems to me to be an advantageous kind of situation where you have a new prophet and you change history, and much like the followers of Joseph Smith, Church of Latter-day Saints, Mormons, who have a new revelation, all of a sudden Christ comes to Central America and changes history there. So a kind of a 1984 readjustment of things after the fact. Politically and personally advantageous revelations to Muhammad. The rituals of Mecca were incorporated into the Quran, into the religion, the pre-Islamic idolatrous rituals. Some of the traditions were brought in to bring in the Jews. Abraham, for example, seems to be an obvious ploy to Jews. But later on, when the Jews rejected Muhammad, they changed away from Jerusalem as a center of prayer and worship. So these kind of things. And the Quran is an adaptation. To accept the Quran is to reject the Bible and vice versa, at least on a historical basis. There are things we change. We can accept from them the Quran as a piece of literature or a document of history, but in terms of a religious document, it's impossible to hold both as revelation because they contradict each other. So those are kind of pluses and minuses. Yeah.
Do miracles play any part in the Islamic faith?
No. And Muhammad was careful to not include that. You know, he wasn't meant to throw people with miracles. But. Okay, I'm sorry, the time is over. If you wish to stay and ask questions.